For today's Sutta class, we continue with the Samadhi section of the Samanyapala Sutta. Last week we looked at the started to look at the first jhana as being one of the higher and more sublime fruits of the holy life. And we had a bit of a look through the meaning of the different words in the jhana formula, and so being one of the very central passages in the Buddhist literature, it's one which is important to know well, to understand what each of the words mean, and have a clear idea, because this is one of the main teachings that the Buddha gave to try to guide us in our meditation. It was just pointed out that we didn't cover the term ekagata last week, but actually that's quite nicely handled in the second jhana anyway, so I might do it in that context. But the just for now, I'd just like to point a little bit at the more description of the jhana, which it then goes into, which I didn't talk about too much last week, which is with each of the jhanas and also the higher knowledges, as well as also we've seen to some extent earlier in the sutta, the Buddha gives some very beautiful descriptions and metaphors for each of the stages, and this being one of the characteristic features of this particular sutta. So whereas the jhana formula itself is very universal, but these other descriptions are found less often. They are found reasonably often elsewhere, but not so standard. So after the formula for the first jhana, it then goes on to say, so imeva kayam viveka jena, so in this very body, viveka jena piti sukhena, the rapture and bliss that is born of seclusion, vivekajan. With that rapture and bliss born of seclusion, he drenches, steeps, saturates, and suffuses this body, such that there is not one tiny bit, not even a kinchi, of the entire body, sabhavato kayasa, that is not suffused, aputang, by this rapture and bliss. So this kind of imagery is very, very characteristic of the Buddha's teachings on samadhi. This is very embodied, it's very imminent. And so this is a kind of a counteraction to the presentation or the idea that samadhi is in some ways sort of a something else. You know, it's like a you meditate in order to get disconnected, and so there are some states that you can get to in your meditation which are kind of dissociated, where you sort of cut off from things. But this one is it's very present, and it's very full. It's not concentrated in the sense of sort of all being forced to be in one place, but they're being so totally drenched through with this rapture and bliss. And then the Buddha goes on to give the simile. Just like a skilled bath attendant, a dako, nahapako, wa nahapakante vasiva. And just to notice the terminology here, the dakha is the skillful one. It's always used in this kind of simile. Bath attendant, nahapako. So, nahayati, This slightly unusual root with NH at the beginning of it is one of the words to bathe. It's probably the only Pali word that begins with that cluster of consonants. And the antevasi, of course, is the same word that's used in the Vinaya for the student. So in the Vinaya you have these two pairs, the upajaya, their student is called the sadivihari, literally one who dwells together, And the acharya, the teacher, their student is called an antevasi. It literally is one who, this similar meaning is one who dwells inside. Ante is inside, vasi is dwelling. So it means someone who's dwelling close by. But that's not just a term for the monastic student, but it's a general term for a student. So it's kind of just an interesting etymology, because it shows that the normal thing for an apprentice in any kind of profession, you know, you're an antevasi, is you dwelt together, you know, you learnt actually by staying in the same place. That's how they learn stuff. Okay, so suppose a skilled bath attendant or his apprentice, and also probably worth just noting in passing that it's a sign of a fairly advanced and decadent society, isn't it? If you can have a whole class of people whose job is to be a bath attendant, yeah, and their job is to do nothing but to sit in the sauna and look after people and whatever, do massages or whatever they were doing there. So, were to pour soap powder, kansatale, into a metal basin. Nayachorna, nhaniyachorna, translated as soap powder or bath powder. Were to pour it into a metal basin, sprinkle it with water. Udakena pariposakam. So, sprinkled with water. And were to sprinkle with water and knead it into a ball, so that the ball of soap powder would be pervaded by moisture, encompassed by moisture, and suffused with moisture inside and out, and yet would not trickle. And so the word it's using for moisture here is sneha. Sneha. It's a very moist kind of word, isn't it? Sneha. English snow, snot, and various other moist things. Yes, sneha. So, curiously enough, sneha also is used as a word for desire or attachment, and in a way similar to tanha, but tanha, of course, meaning thirst, but then coming to mean desire or attachment as well, whereas sneha is like the opposite meaning, is moisture, but also meaning desire or attachment. And so that moisture, it putta, okay, it suffuses, the same word that we've had up here for the piti and sukha and jhana, snehena, and yet it would not trickle out. So these similes which the Buddha is using are very precise, okay? In this particular simile, there's this idea that the ball of, I'm not exactly sure what it would be. Does anyone know what this bath powder is? Jorna? No? Anyone seen people using that? I think it's been replaced by soap these days. It probably would be. It'd probably be some kind of fine clay or something like that. Yeah, some kind of mud or clay or mineral sort of thing, which would be sort of used for so kind of like an abrasive cleaning thing.
In one place in India, there is ash mixed with cleaning liquid.
Yeah. Well, ash, that's basically how you make basic soap, isn't it? Ash and fat. So there's some kind of powder, and so that the idea is clear enough, and so that it's being like massaged into a ball with the moisture, you know, a bit like you're kneading, like kind of kneading a lump of dough or something like that. And so when you're kneading the lump of dough, you have to knead it until the moisture is, or mixing cement, of course, being perhaps more more pertinent. You got to mix it until the moisture, yeah, it goes everywhere, but it doesn't trickle out, yeah. So that the kneading is the vitaka vichara, okay, in the first jhana. So it's like this kind of it's being kneaded like that, yeah. Yeah? Whereas it's need as in, you know what need? I have all these ESL people here. I'm never quite sure. Need, you know, that is not. I'm not talking about need as in that kind of need. I'm talking about need as in that kind of need. Yeah. So you're kind of needing it. Vitaka the vichara is needing. The sukha is the moisture itself, yeah? And the movement of it, the movement is the fact that it's moving is like the rapture. The act of moving it is the vitaka vichara, the force that's moving it. The moisture itself is the sukha. And the fact that it doesn't flow out, of course, is the one-pointedness. Right? So each detail in this, these similes is very precise. And I'll show you as we go on, we'll have a look at some of the other similes, and you'll see that each one reflects the jhana quite precisely. So, and then Buddha goes on in the same way that the bhikkhu soaks, steeps and suffuses his entire body such that it's entirely filled with the rapture and bliss born of seclusion, but that there's nothing, no part of his body that's unsuffused. And the finishes of this great king is a fruit of the holy life, which is apparent here and now, and which is better and more refined, higher and more refined than those mentioned previously. Now, in this particular thing, there's one very important interpretive problem, which I've avoided up to now, but which I want to talk about, is the meaning of the word kaya in this particular context. Now, the word kaya, which you find all the way through here, is normally a word meaning the body. Okay, so the kaya is the most normal word in Pali meaning body. And so this particular descriptive passage, of course, is very, you know, it's very embodied. It mentions kaya several times, and it seems to be quite a physical experience. And yet we've already seen that it seems that kind of the awareness of the body disappears in jhana. That seems to be implied, I think, by the first phrase, as we discussed last week, so viveceva kamehi. That's a complex discussion in itself, but then the question goes, if that's correct. So there's two schools of thought on this. One school of thought is that to take kaya in its literal meaning, as meaning the body, and to say, well, therefore it means that you are aware of your body and you can actually feel your body and you can feel the rapture and bliss filling it up. And then the other school of thought says that kaya doesn't mean literally the physical body here, but has a more subtle meaning. Now, just to give a bit of background to this, I'll just... Okay, so you can see by the length of the entry here, that it's obviously a very common word. And so it's important to remember this when we're interpreting these things, okay? Because this is why I brought this up, because when we're learning Pali and we're studying these things, you know, we read it and we think, well, kaya means the body, therefore, you know, it must mean the physical body. And, you know, but of course, the more common the words are, usually the broader the meanings they have. And we can easily think in English of plenty of ways that we use, for example, the word body. We can say a body of work, or we can say the corporate body, or many different meanings that it has. And so in Pali as well, it also has a number of different meanings. So it's just the basic meanings here. The root is chi, chinoti, to heap up. Group, heap, collection, aggregate, body. And it's given a number of synonyms here in the Pali. These are from the commentaries. Kaya kuti, it's called a kuti, which is interesting. It's kuti meaning kuti, of course. It's called a guha, is a cave. Deha is, and sandeha literally is the body or the corpse. Nava is a boat. Ratha is a chariot. Dhaja is a flag. Vamika is an anthill. Kutika is a little kuti. Kaya equals a sarira. Okay, another word just meaning the corpse or the deha. And so these are the most normal meanings for the actual physical body in Pali is the kaya or the deha, sometimes rupa. sarira, or another one is interesting is bondi, which is spelled exactly the same as the word bondi, which is an interesting little reflection there. So here's some of the basic meanings. Kaya is a mahajana, a collection of people or a crowd. Okay, so that's one meaning of kaya applied. And so the seven kayas in the Jataka. Okay, so the great masses or substances of things, vedanakaya, sanyakaya. So for example, you know, you have vedanakaya, vijnanakaya. So vijnanakaya doesn't mean a literal physical body, but it means the whole mass of things of vijnana. All we've seen in the Pakudakachayana's theory in the Samanyapala Sutta itself, the seven bodies which are unmade and so on. So these like seven, groups of sensations and things like that. In other words, akaya is used for the realms of rebirth. So you have asurakaya or abhasarakaya for the different, or devakaya for the different realms in which beings can be born. Okay, so kaya is a... physical body, of course, another way, and psychologically is also the basis of the organ of touch. So kaya, material body, similarly, institution of body, physical, psychological, and so on, ethical. Also is used in the sense of the three actions by mean of the body, as opposed to speech and mind and so on. And various other meanings, which we don't need to go through all of them. But I should say that in the commentaries, one of the meanings of kaya is it's in the sense of a collection of things. Is you have the term nama kaya. I'm not sure if it probably has that here. Where are we? No. I don't think to have namakaya. So namakaya is the nama being the mental qualities of feeling, perception, attention, intention, and contact, and the namakaya simply being the group of those five things together. Okay, that's the namakaya. Now in meditation you have the word kaya pasadhi, yeah, which is the case here, which is the bodily tranquility, which seemed to me, the most obvious meaning is that obviously when you meditate your body becomes tranquil, yeah. But the commentaries to that, interestingly enough, explain that it's the tranquility of the namakaya, so the tranquility of the mental factors, and chitta pasadhi is the tranquility of consciousness itself. So whether that's true or not, but there is certainly a tendency among the commentaries to interpret these meditation terms in terms of the namakaya. And if you have a look at some of the other meanings here, you have this other meaning which is kaya sakhi, and the kaya sakhi is one who's realized and gained the final truth concerning the body is not the correct translation. What it means is he's literally seen with the body. And so this it's actually found in the instrumental form, kayena sachi karoti. One sees or realizes something with the body. Okay, so obviously there it doesn't mean physical body, but in some sense is meant to mean the consciousness in some way. What seems to be going on, or what my interpretation of all this is, that the word kaya has an idiom that means, as an idiom, it can mean an idiom as something like very directly or personally to experience something. So to experience something kayena means you really sort of get in there and realize it in very very directly and personally. And so that seems to be implied by a number of the contexts that it appears in. In some places, it definitely can't mean the physical body. It talks about, for example, in the formless attainments, the arupa jhanas, it talks about realizing those with the body, kayena. It talks about realizing the cessation of perception of feeling is said to be realized with the body. The even nibbana itself, the ultimate truth, paramattha satya, is said to be realized with the body. Yeah. Now, obviously, none of those cases can kaya mean purely and simply the physical body in the ordinary sense. So what we're seeing is like a movement where in the earlier stages of meditation, where, for example, it talks about, say, you're doing breath meditation and you experience kaya pasadhi, bodily tranquility. Well, to me, it seems the most rational, you know, reasonable thing is, well, your breath is becoming tranquil and your body becomes tranquil when you're meditating, yeah? And so there we're talking about a physical thing. At the end of the path, the realization of the ultimate truth, you're obviously talking about something which is not physical at all. And in between, it seems to me it's kind of a moving from one to the other. So it's neither definitively mental or definitively physical. To me, when I read these descriptions, I can never see this as a lot of people see this as being very problematic. I can never see it as being problematic, because to me it's exactly what meditation feels like, is that when you go into meditation, you experience your body. And as you know, we've been doing this metta practice, and this metta practice is based on developing the rapture and bliss in the way exactly as it's described here, of saturating and soaking it and suffusing it through your whole body. And then as you do that, you can feel that this is actually suffused through your whole body, and you can feel it in the body like that. And as the meditation goes on and the samadhi becomes deeper and the one-pointedness becomes deeper, then your awareness of the body side of things tends to drop away. But it's not like you're going somewhere, it's not like you're somewhere outside your body. You're not sort of going from your body out to somewhere else. But you just, it's just that the rapture and bliss is just so much in there that you're just not seeing the physicality of it anymore. And so this is, to me, this is what this is how I read these passages. This is actually what I think what it's talking about. So it's one of these things that to me it's difficult to say in theory, does it mean the physical body or not, but when you're practicing it, it just feels like it's right. But anyway, that's my thoughts on that. I don't know if anyone has any other. And that's right. And the Pali can be quite specific when it wants to specifically refer to this olarika body, the coarse physical body. Which is this body made up of the four elements produced from rice and bread and so on. So it can be very specific when it wants to be.
It's missing the wrong views.
Mm.
There's about seven wrong views to do with different types of bodies. First one is physical. Next one is.
Here we go. Yeah, because some samanas and brahmins who are teachers of annihilationism, and on seven bases they teach the breakup and annihilation of this body. Annihilation of this being. And the first one, what seven bases? And then this self, which is rupi, physical, chatu mahabhutiko, made up of the four great elements, mata petika sambhavo, produced by mother and father, kayasa bheda uchijasi vinasati, with the breakup of the body, is cut off and destroyed, does not exist after death. This is the first, and then it is thus that this self is rightly cut off. And then the next one is another. There is another self. So this is talking about different kinds of self rather than different kinds of body. Although it does say this is this kind of self which is divine, rupi, physical, yeah, and which is belongs to the sense sphere world and eats the kabalinkara, which is the some kind of divine food, and this breaks up after death. And the next one is another kind of self which is divine also and rupi also, but is made by mind, sabanga pachangi, comprised of all the limbs and faculties, all the limbs and not bereft of any faculties. But this also points to that point you made earlier before, Blake, that the idea that beings in heaven realms are felt to have a body, so they're clearly rupi, which is not merely just a body in a vague sense, but specifically has all of the limbs and faculties and so on. Yeah? So it's and that would apply to the form realms, form jhana realms, because then the next one it says with then this self transcending all form and so on gets into the ka sancha yatana, reborn in the sphere infinite space, and then so on for the other arupa attainments of the body in that context. So any more questions on that one before we go on to the second jhana? If only doing it was as easy as talking about it. Okay, so the second jhana, Punacha Param. Okay, again and further, great king, the bhikkhu. I thought I apologize for the unpolitically correct language. What can I do? Vitaka vicharanam vupatama. Okay, so this is ablative form. From the stilling vupasama, so the root here is sama, the English same. It's the same root as the word samatha, not the same root as the word samadhi, but samatha, sama, meaning same or even, and upa, prefix, and vi upa, meaning double prefix, meaning super, dupa, rupa, meaning super. You can remember that one. super stilling, due to the super stilling of vitaka and vichara. Okay. Adhyatang sampasadanam. Internally, one's confident. And this word pasada is a very interesting word. Basic meaning of it is clarity. And but sampasada also means confidence. But that's similar in the English idiom that you say, well, if you don't know something and then you understand it, say, well, I'm clear about that now. So you've got rid of your doubts about something. So it means clarity, it means faith, serenity. Chetaso eko di bhavam. So the heart, the cheto, has become, it's in a state, a bhava, of oneness, eko di. Now the word chetaso, in Pali there are a number of, quite a few words for the mind. Yeah? We're familiar with chitta, mano, vijnana, and what are some other ones? Anyway, I'll leave that for now. But cheto is also one of the other ones. Now, cheto is used a little bit less, it's from the same root as chitta, it's used a little bit less commonly, but cheto most of the time is used in a context where you could translate it fairly well by the English word heart. Okay? Actually, in Pali, they occasionally, in poetry, use the word heart as well, the physical heart, hṛdaya, in the sense of mind, which is actually cognate with the English heart. It's not used very widely, it's actually only used in poetry. But the word cheto, for example, in the Brahma Viharas, Chetasa viharati, so one pervades all the four directions with a heart filled with loving kindness. So these kinds of contexts you tend to find the emotional context that the cheto is used. So there was one pointedness of heart or unification of heart. Okay.
And it's manasikara kind of similar to vijnana. Kind of
Not quite, no. Manasikara is more specific. Manasikara is the, like turning the mind towards something. Yeah? So like if you if you hear a sound, you look out the window, so that the manasikara is the turning, and then the consciousness is the actual hearing. Of course, you have to have consciousness beforehand to be aware of the sound, and then the response to that is that the manasikara turns around. Yeah? Ekodi bhavang, avitakang avicharang. So notice how it repeats here, no utaka, no vichara. Okay? Again, this is simply part of the idiom, part of the oral idiom that you avoid losing meaning. Okay? There's no skin off anybody's nose to repeat the phrases. But if you lose it, then you're in big trouble. And so it's exactly like maintaining the files on our computers. And as the law of someone, I can't remember who it is, one of the IT gurus' law was, if data isn't backed up twice, it doesn't exist. Okay, so that was the law which the redactors of the Pali Canon obviously took to heart. Mm-hmm. If it's not repeated at least twice, it doesn't exist. Yeah. And so when you read it, you think it's annoying, but it's actually very, very prudent and very, very wise in terms of information preservation. Avitakang avicharang samadhijang iti sukhang. So remember in the first jhana we had the vivekajang iti sukhang. Okay, so it's the rapture and bliss born of seclusion because one's left. Yeah, we started out viviceva kamehi, viviceva kusalehi damehi. So he's now secluded from that whole sensual world, and the mind has this bliss and rapture because of that. Here, the bliss and rapture is deepened. It's not just because we've stepped out of that world, but because of our own confidence and unification in this world of samadhi, and this is where the rapture and bliss comes up. And so this is this whole tendency here. You can see, you think of it as like taking a further step inside, like first jhana you've stepped into the room, upachara samadhi, you're just on the door, the fringe, the threshold. First jhana you've stepped into the room and you're happy because you're out of the rain, you're out of the wind, you're out of the sun or whatever. Yeah, and then you take, and the second jhana you're taking another step into the room, and so the fact that you're secluded from the elements outside becomes less important to you, but what's important is that you're actually in this comfortable space here inside the room, and you're happy now to be here because it's very comfortable and so on, and you're more confident. So again, that's that second step inside. The mind is more confident and more unified. And so it's at this stage that the jhana formula first mentions ekodi bhavam, which is a synonym for ekagata, oneness or one-pointedness of mind. And ekodi bhavam is like a state of unification, and ekagata is like a a peak or point of mind, the agam. So in some context it uses one or the other, but they're basically just synonyms. Now, there are some places where the first jhana is also said to possess ekagata. Okay, so that's also said, and there's the five jhana factors, five factors of the first jhana, which are? Vitaka, excellent. Vichara? Yeah? Viti. Sukha and ekagata. Excellent. Excellent. Well, you're doing much better than the family you had dana with on the weekend, and I asked them, okay, what's the Eightfold Path? And they kind of look at each other.
Did they get one?
They got a few, yeah. Eventually they got most of them, yeah. So it was good. So there's the five jhana factors. So these are mentioned elsewhere, not in the standard formula. So it's not meaning to imply that the first jhana does not have one-pointedness. It's merely that it's more emphasized in the second jhana. And again, I would say that's also to do with the ending of the vitaka vichara, that you no longer, there's no longer that kind of, that kneading or that massaging, yeah, of the mind with the vitaka vichara. And again, to notice how that I should have mentioned this earlier, that when we talked about the vitakka vichara, how, you know, that to me that idea of needing gives a very good idea of the actual samadhi experience of what that vitakka vichara is like. Yeah? It's not something which is actually kind of, you know, thinking in that kind of way, but kind of needing the meditation object, just kind of massaging the meditation object. But now even that kind of movement has finished, and so that there's a more complete unification. And I always remember Ajahn Brahm's simile that first jhana was like a tennis ball, whereas the second jhana is like a bowling ball. First jhana is a little bit fuzzy around the edges, and you can squeeze it a bit. And so again, as with the previous one, he soaks, steeps and suffuses this very body with that rapture and bliss born of samadhi. And then goes on for another simile. Just as great king, or supposed great king, Seyatapi Maharaja, Udaka Rahado. Udaka and Rahado. It was a deep lake which is very, very deep, and which is whose waters welled up from underneath. Yeah, ubhidodako. There would be no inlet for water from the east, west, the north, or the south. Okay. Nor would it be refilled from time to time by the rain. Okay, so the idiom in Pali is for the rain. It always says the deva will be rain, so the deva doesn't rain down. Yeah, the deva doesn't rain down. So it's kind of interesting, that personalization, but remembering that deva is related to the English day. Yeah, so it's like it's halfway between meaning the deva and meaning the sky. Atako, yet a current of cool water welling up from underneath the pond would drench, steep, saturate and suffuse, using the same series of verbs we've had before. So underneath the lake is a sita. The Sita, the cool water, Varidhara, Sita, Varidhara, Ubhijitva. Okay, so that the whole water, Sitena Varina, would be soaked through with that beautiful cool water. And of course, cool, the idea of a pool filled with cool water is probably a lot more attractive if you're in India in the hot season than it is in Bandanu in the winter time. But nevertheless, I'm sure we can empathise. And so the bhikkhu would soak and saturate his body with the rapture and bliss born of samadhi. And so here, again, notice that the precision of the simile is always very impressive to me, that each one of these is quite, is chosen and described very carefully. So again, remember in the first one, it said that the water didn't trickle out. Yeah, remember that one? In the bath powder? The water didn't trickle. But it just kind of put that right at the end, and it said the water doesn't trickle out. Yeah? So again, just that idea that the first jhana is one-pointedness, but it's not so emphasized. Whereas here it's saying, it's emphasizing this point again and again and again, that there's no water coming from the south, there's no water coming from the east, there's no water coming from the west, there's no water coming from the north, and the rain doesn't fall into it and fill it up from time to time. So it's emphasizing this kind of one-pointedness, that the pool is so filled. Yeah? And again, the idea of the kneading, the force that's being applied to it by the vitakka vichara, is now absent, that's been dropped away. But instead you have this welling, this upwelling from underneath, which is the rapture welling up underneath. The coolness of the water is the sukha. Yeah? And then the fact that the pond is so self-contained is the one-pointedness.
Somebody's also not the G5 idea.
I mean, it's a very attractive image, you know, and so it's, you know, it's just so not, you know, forcible and aggressive and all of these things. It's just very, very kind of gentle. You see, it's meant to, you know, you sort of just imagine that, you know. They're very good images just to imagine, and it just calls your mind off.
These images of water, something to do with the mind itself, like maybe if you can see it. So the first one is, there's water there that's kind of dirty, you know, with all the powder. The second one, the water is now more clear, and I think the next thing, I'm not sure, there's more water.
And second one also is what is clear, yeah. I mean, it's used many times. I mean, it has the simile of the five hindrances, like the water with the five kinds of you know, things to obscure the water. So yeah, this is a simile for the mind. Yeah. Well, more than that, I mean, it's a simile for the mind, yeah. But it's saying more than stillness, yeah. The coolness of the water is the sukha, yeah. The welling up of it is the rapture. These are all different qualities of water, yeah. And then there's other similes where it talks about the five hindrances, and then there's like five kinds of pollution in the mind. So if the water is dyed or very bright, then that's like the karma chanda. If it's sort of boiling and agitated, then it's like ill will and so on. So it illustrates not just, see, that I think the idea is that the clarity of the water, being able to see through it, is like the awareness of the mind. But then all the other qualities of water can illustrate other qualities of the mind as well. You know? And water is fantastic for that, because it takes on, you know, it's very passive, it takes on the qualities of things around it. Okay, so this too is a fruit of the holy life, which is higher and more sublime than those which have come previously. Punicha param, and again and beyond, great king. Bhikkhu, piti ya cha viraga upekhako cha viharati sato sampajano sukhanchakayena patisangvedeti yantang arya achikanti upekhako satima sukhavihariti tatiyang jhanang upasampadja viharati. So with the fading away of rapture, the piti is now fading away, yeah? And so this word viraga is a very interesting one. It has two basic meanings, which actually come back to the same root, but the basic root of raga is like a dye. Something which dies, and so again it's related to that water imagery of the kind of the water with dye in it, which is brightly coloured, and so, but it also comes to mean lust and desire. So to say viraga means, can be translated as dispassion, yeah? So viraga equals dispassion, if we take raga as meaning lust or desire, but also the virajati means to fade away. It's used when the ink leaves the clothes, when you're washing your clothes and the ink fades out of it. Okay, so it also means fading away. Sometimes the translators will try to combine them by saying it's fading away of lust or something like that. Actually, it has those quite distinct meanings, and so here, you know, you could translate it as having dispassion towards your rapture, but more probably in this case, more apt to translate it as being the fading away of rapture. And it is interesting that it sort of suggests a gradual process, you know, viraga, like normally, you know, something it disappears, it doesn't sort of gradually,
washing out,
yeah. Upeka kocha viharati, one abides equanimous. Okay, so one dwells, again this word viharati, meaning one dwelling, they're staying. Equanimous. And here upeka means equanimity as a, as the attitude of equanimity. Okay, so upekkha has the two meanings. One is the how do you say disinterested, and the other meaning is neutral feeling. Someone has a disinterested attitude. Put it that way. Attitude. So there's two meanings of upekkha. It has a disinterested attitude and has a neutral feeling, and the neutral feeling, of course, is classified according to the Abhidhamma. It's classified in the Vedana Khanda, and upekkha as a disinterested attitude is classified in the Sankhara Khanda. Okay, so it's very important to understand the difference here, and this difference is made very clear in this third jhana, where you have sukha, so you still have the pleasant feeling, but you have the upekkha towards it. You have the disinterested attitude towards the pleasant feeling. Okay, and here you can see from and the basic root of upekkha, of course, is upa plus ikkha. Okay, ikkha meaning to watch something, to look at something. So upekkha means to watch over something. So it means like watching over, but being disinterested. All right, and again, does everyone understand what disinterested means? So disinterested isn't the same as disinterested versus uninterested. Do you know the difference between these two, apart from the fact that one of them is spelled correctly and one of them is not? Is everyone clear about what the difference between those two is? Yeah. I'm just checking whether anyone was awake at the time. Yeah, but that's good. Excellent. Thanks, Blake. That's good. It makes me feel good about myself. Sorry. You don't know? Well, the difference is what happens when you get taken to court. Right? You want your judge to be disinterested, but not uninterested. So when the judge is disinterested, means he doesn't have any preferences, he's not favouring and opposing to one party or the other. But if he's uninterested, then he's bored and falling asleep and not paying attention. Yeah? So this is the difference.
Disinterested is unbiased?
Unbiased, exactly, yeah.
I think you're getting this question in Sydney, and the only reason me and...
So disinterested and uninterested. So it means you're very interested in it, yeah? But you're not biased, you're not pushing one way or the other. And that, if you look back here, if you look back here at the structure of the sentence, then you can see that phrase on the upekkha is just after the pitiyacha viraga, yeah? So that what's happening is that one's attitude, so these are like the attitudes or the emotional response to your meditation, and especially to the pleasant feeling and the bliss of meditation. The piti is a slightly excited emotional response, like the welling up of the water underneath the pond, yeah? Whereas the upekkha is now cooler emotional response, that one's just aware of it, just watching it. So this is what's happening between, this is the difference between the second jhana and the third jhana, is that the upwelling, kind of the slightly excited or feeling of the rapture fades away, and that there's more, the sense of bliss is more just watching over. And again, reinforced by just saying sato sampajano, mindful and clearly comprehending. So of course it doesn't mean that you didn't have mindfulness and clear comprehension earlier, and obviously we had the practice on mindfulness and clear comprehension long before even entering jhana, yeah? And so it's not saying that the first two jhanas don't have it, it's merely saying it by way of emphasis. Just the same as we saw with the one-pointedness, it's not mentioned in the first jhana, but it's mentioned in the second jhana by way of one of emphasis. It doesn't mean that the first jhana is not one-pointed, okay? But here, because it's emphasizing that attitude, mindfully is watching. Sukhancha kayena patasangvedeti, one experiences bliss with the body. Yantang arya aji kanti, that which the Aryans declare, equanimous and mindful, one dwells in bliss. So it's kind of interesting that the noble ones do have a nice saying to say about the third jhana, but not about any of the other jhanas, yeah? So this is a little kind of quirk in the jhana formula. I'm not quite sure why that one is only declared the Aryans there. I might say something in the commentary on that. Sorry? So you're just getting a bit bored of it. And
maybe because this is the last jhana where there's pleasure. And of course, there's no pleasure.
Yeah, but why would the Aryans praise it? Okay, so just a few bits here from the Visuddhimagga on these things. Visuddhimagga, Visuddhimagga, you will be pleased to know I've given two kinds meaning of equanimity. Visuddhimagga gives about 10 kinds of equanimity. Okay, so if the two kinds of equanimity is not enough for you, then do yourself a favor and have a look at that. Mindful and fully aware. It says, why is it mentioned here? It says, for mindfulness and fully aware, although it exists in the earlier jhanas as well, because one who is forgetful and not fully aware does not even get access, concentration, let alone absorption, yet because of the comparative grossness of those jhanas, the mind's going is easy there like a man on level ground, and so the functions of mindfulness and fully awareness are not evident in them. Curious. But it's only stated here because the subtlety of this jhana, which is due to the abandoning of the gross factors, requires that the mind's going always includes the functions of mindfulness and full awareness, like that of a man on a razor's edge. Not entirely persuaded by that. Explanation. Another explanation, just as a calf that follows a cow returns to the cow when taken away from her, if not prevented, so too when this third jhana is led away from happiness, it would return to happiness if not prevented by if it led away from rapture, it would return to rapture, the piti, if not prevented by mindfulness and full awareness, and would rejoin rapture. And besides, beings are greedy for bliss, and this kind of bliss is exceedingly sweet, since there is none greater. But here there is non-greed for the bliss owing to the influence of the mindfulness and full awareness, not for any other reason. And so it talks about feeling bliss with the body. Nevertheless, he feels bliss associated with the mental body, the Namakaya. And then after the jhana, he would also feel bliss, since the material body would have been affected by the exceedingly superior matter originated by that bliss associated with the mental body. This is one of the commentarial theories, is that when you're practicing jhana or something like that, that at the time the body actually produces a kind of a subtle matter, a physical elements or something of some kind, which suffuse your body during that attainment, and so due to that, that you feel blissful afterwards. So, and I think quite a reasonable theory that certainly when you're in the jhana, then your body sort of is so tranquil and becomes very purified. Okay, so the. Okay, so why do the noble ones praise this third jhana? So this man, or the one practicing this third jhana, because he is worthy of praise. for this man is worthy of praise since he has equanimity towards the third jhana, even though it possesses exceedingly sweet bliss and has reached the perfection of bliss, and he is not drawn towards it by a liking for the bliss, and he is mindful with the mindfulness established in order to prevent the arising of happiness and the arising of rapture, and he feels with his mental body, Namakaya, the undefiled bliss, beloved of the noble ones, cultivated by the noble ones, because he's worthy of praise in this way. It should be understood that this is why the Aryas praise him. So it still doesn't really explain why they don't praise the other jhanas, but anyway. Anyway, so it's good. The Aryans think, go team. Tatiyang jhanang upasampaja enters and abides in the third jhana. Okay, so then it goes on to give, and again, deep soaks and suffuses his body with the happiness free from rapture, and with the bliss free from rapture. Now, just as great king, there is a lotus pond. And so the translation says there's a lotus pond. The Pali is Upaliniyang wa Paduminiyang wa Pundarikiniyang wa. Of course, Pali having an abundance of words for lotuses and, of course, different kinds of lotus ponds. Okay, with and then there were certain blue, white, or red lotuses were to be born in the water, Udike Jatani, grow in the water, Udike Sangwadhani, and never rise above the water. Yeah? But flourish immersed in the water. Anto nimugga posini. Okay, so again, this whole kind of idea of this immersion, this kind of embodied immersive quality in the meditation. From their tips, their tips of them is the agga. To the root is the mula. With then they would be steeped, soaked, saturated, and suffused with that cool water. Sitena varina. And there would be no part of those lotuses not suffused with cool water. In the same way, this bhikkhu drenches, steeps, saturates and suffuses his body with the happiness free from rapture, so that there's no part of his entire body which is not suffused by this happiness. This is another visible fruit of the holy life, which is higher and more sublime than the previous ones. So again here the simile is very, very beautiful, very obviously meant to be very sort of emotionally engaging and attractive, and making you to kind of want to experience that, and giving this very kind of cooling, beautiful, pleasant images in the mind. But also at the same time being very precise in its meaning and its application. So the cool water, as always, is the sukha. And here it's lost the upwelling, yeah. So that idea of the welling up in the second jhana, the rapture of the second jhana is not there, and that is just there, yeah. It's just right, and there's that. And this is what's emphasized in this particular simile. It's born in the water, it's grown in the water, and it's just dwelling there, immersed in the water. So it's just like it's a complete stillness. It's always been there. There's none of this idea of the kneading in the first jhana or the upwelling in the second jhana, but it's just completely there, in its place, completely immersed in the water. So any questions on the third jhana?
I'm
just
Is it maybe more difficult to fall away from third jhana, first and second, maybe you can lose more easily? So maybe if someone gets to the third, that's when the Aryans praise him.
I don't know. I would kind of doubt it, but that seems to be the implication in the Visuddhi Magga description. So the beings are sort of looking for that rapture. But I wouldn't have thought so. I mean, the third jhana is obviously more stable than the second jhana. So I wouldn't have thought it was easy to fall away from it.
From the first, so it's easy to fall away.
I would
have
thought so.
Once you get to the third, it's kind of on the way. And
yeah, more economist. Maybe that's what, and maybe that's it, yeah. Okay, so to the fourth jhana, Punachaparam, again and beyond, great king, a bhikkhu sukhasa chapahana, with the abandoning of sukha, dukkha satchapahana, the abandoning of dukkha. So it means that when you're sitting in the third jhana, you're sitting there thinking, oh, it's so painful, oh, it's so painful. No, not really. Pubeva, the previous somanasa and domanasa, have disappeared. Atangama. Atangama is the word that's used, for example, when the sun disappears behind the horizon. Pubeva means the previous. Somanasa is these two words, somanasa and domanasa. Okay, so we've got to get a bit of terminology going here. Somanasa, domanasa. And here we have sukha and dukkha. And the last one, upekkha. So this is actually a group of five, which is an alternative classification for feeling. Of course, we all know the most common way of classifying the Vedana or feeling in Buddhism is the threefold, sukha, dukkha, and neva sukha na dukkha, yeah? Pleasant, painful, and neither pleasant nor painful. But occasionally we find this fivefold classification, and this is explained that in this context, okay, so when it's in the five, these have a slightly different meaning. Normally, sukha just means any kind of pleasant feeling. But when it's part of this group of five, sukha means specifically physical pleasant feeling. And similarly with dukkha, normally it means any kind of painful feeling, but in the group of five it means specifically physical painful feeling. Somanasa means specifically pleasant mental feeling. Okay? And it's from the root su, meaning good, and manas is the mind. Okay, so it's quite explicit. It means pleasant mental feeling, and domanasa, of course, being the opposite, du, bad mindedness. Okay, and so in this context, here is where we have, as I was saying before, this is where we have the neutral feeling, the upekkha as a neutral feeling. Okay. So here upekkha has the same meaning as neva dukkha na sukha, neither pleasant nor painful feeling. Okay. So this is a fivefold classification of feelings which we encounter from time to time in the suttas, and obviously is closely related to the language that's being used here in the fourth jhana. Okay. So the point in the fourth jhana is that one has both the both the equanimity as feeling, as well as the equanimity of the attitude, the disinterested attitude. So, and I guess we're just reinforcing, and again reinforcing, the abandoning of pleasure and pain, mental pleasure and pain, completely gone, any kind of pleasure and pain. This is what's meant here. It's not trying to imply that previous jhanas have had suffering or have had mental unpleasant feeling, obviously. But again, as we found many times here, it's reinforcing by repetition. All of those things, they're gone, they've completely gone. And then, upekkha sati parisuddhiṃ. So purification literally is the purity, parisuddhi, equanimity, and sati. The way that this compound is construed is it can be construed a number of different ways. It can be construed as purity of equanimity and mindfulness, or it could be construed as with equanimity purified by mindfulness, or mindfulness purified by equanimity, and so on. In Pali, the elements of a compound are not the relationship between the elements of the compound can be construed in a number of different ways. I might just give the commentary probably acknowledges those things here. For the mindfulness in this jhana is quite purified, and its purification is caused by equanimity, not by anything else. That's why it's said to have purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. Also, it's said in the Vibhanga of the Abhidhamma, this mindfulness is cleared, purified, clarified by equanimity. Hence, it is said to have purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. And the equanimity due to which there comes to be this purity of mindfulness should be understood as specific neutrality in meaning. So, and not only mindfulness is purified by it here, but also all associated states. However, the teaching is given under the heading of mindfulness. And just again, just explanation here, so I understand what the commentary is talking about. It says specific neutrality. Which is a classic piece of Buddhist hybrid English, Tatra Majhadatta, which is a translation of the commentarial term, Tatra Majhadatta, which literally means specific neutrality. Tatra means right there, and Majhadatta means middleness. And so, because of this ambiguity in the word upekha, the commentaries have invented this term, which is quite an artificial term. That's why actually the translation specific neutrality is quite good, because it's as artificial in English as it is in Pali. So this is an artificial Pali technical term which was invented by the commentaries in order to avoid that ambiguity of the use of upekkha. So this means upekkha as the attitude, the sankhara of upekkha, the onlooking with equanimity rather than the neutral feeling. So here it's saying that the main point of this is that it's the upekkha, the tatra majhadatta, which is meant here, the attitude of equanimity rather than the feeling of equanimity, although of course both are important. Herein, this equanimity exists in the three lower jhanas too, but just as, although a crescent moon exists by day, but is not purified or clear since it is outshone by the sun's radiance in the daytime, or since it is deprived of the night, which is its ally, owing to gentleness and owing to helpfulness to it. So too, this crescent moon of equanimity, consisting in specific neutrality, exists in the first jhana, etc., but it is not purified since it is outshone by the glare of the opposing states, consisting in vitaka and so on. And since it is deprived of the night of equanimity as feeling for its ally, and because it is not purified, the conascent mindfulness and other states are not purified either, like the unpurified crescent moon's radiance by day. Okay, so that's quite a nice description of why this is mentioned here. Now then it goes on, as always, to the simile. Uses his entire body with pure bright mind. So again, this is an interesting variation. In the previous ones, in the first jhana, it was the viveka jena bhiti sukhena, so the body suffused with the rapture and bliss born of seclusion. In the second jhana, it's the samadhi jena bhiti sukhena, which is body is suffused with. In the third jhana, the body is suffused nipitikena sukhena, with bliss without rapture. Okay, nipiti kena sukena. And now in the third jhana it says that the body is suffused kayasa parisuddhena chetasa pariyodatena, that the mind is suffused with pure bright mind. So sorry, the body is suffused with pure bright mind, chetasa. And again, notice the same word cheto that we found in the second jhana, meaning the heart. So it's like this, instead of it being the feeling of suffused with the feeling, it's suffused with pure awareness, a purified and bright awareness of the fourth jhana. And so this being one of the things it signifies, fourth jhana actually is somewhat different than the first three in this respect, in this clarity of awareness. Then it goes on to the simile. Suppose a man were to be sitting covered from the head downward with a white cloth, so that there would be no part of his entire body not suffused by the white cloth. In the same way, the bhikkhu sits suffusing his body with a pure bright mind, so there's no part of the entire body not suffused by a pure bright mind. And this is another great king, fruit of the holy life, which is apparent here and now, and which is higher and more sublime than those which have come previously. So this particular simile, some people feel that this simile is a bit of a letdown, right? And of course, in a sense, it's like following kind of a natural process. You know, you've almost had like the first one where the bath powder is being kneaded. It's almost like you're getting ready for the bath, yeah. And then you sort of jumped in there and splashed around in the lotus pond for a while, and now you've got out from the bath, and here you are. With covered with a dry cloth, and so again, this, you know, it's a very kind of beautiful feeling, isn't it? You know, when you've had a bath and you feel all kind of clean and cool and refreshed, and then you can sort of get out, and then you sit and dry, and cover yourself with a towel or something outside the place. And so, of course, the dryness of it again is signifies that the wetness of the water is the sukha. Yeah? And so in this case, it's a feeling of somebody who's enjoyed what they wanted to enjoy. Yeah? They've had the bath, they've had all that the pleasure of doing what they wanted to do and so on in the lotus pond, and they're clean and so on, and now they don't need to do anything. Yeah? So they don't even need to enjoy having the bath. Yeah? They're just sitting there and just totally, completely content to sit there. And so here, rather than the mind being symbolized by the coolness of the water, here the mind is symbolized by the purity of the white cloth. Okay, and this of course being another classic simile of the mind found in the Buddhist texts quite regularly.
What happened to the breath?
The breath? Well, fourth channel, the breath is completely gone. But remember that the jhana formulas are very general, so they're not only applying to breath meditation.
But some teachers say by the fourth jhana, then you don't do the breath stop.
That's right, yeah. That's stated elsewhere in the suttas. Yeah, there are some places in the suttas that say that. Where? Well, off the top of my head, in the Anguttara. Nines? Seven and a half?
Typically say
let's see if I can in the fourth jhana. Yeah, it says in the fourth jhana that the breath is completely stopped. Yeah. Oh, it's actually in the
I don't know whether I remember correctly or not, but I think the Buddha also says that when one is in the fourth jhana, the breathing is stopped, but actually we are actually breathing through our skin.
Yeah, that's what they say, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, here we go. So this is in the Ariyavasa Sutta, second Ariyavasa Sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, number 10.20. Characteristics. It says here the Aryan, but actually here the Aryan is used to apply to all, to Arahants only actually. And six qualities of them. One is that they've abandoned they've abandoned five qualities, the five hindrances, completely abandoned. They're endowed with six things, that is equanimity towards all six sense objects. They guard one thing, that is they guard the mind with mindfulness. They are four, this is Sankha Yekang. Four kinds of, I can't remember the translation of that. Four kinds of attitude or something. I can't remember the translation. That they cultivate some things after reflecting. That they endure some things after reflecting. That they dwell dispel some things after reflecting, and that they parivajeti. I'm not sure the difference. Can't remember the difference. Parivajeti. We know deity is to dispel. Parivajeti. get rid of or something, some things after reflecting. And they've got rid of reliance on different kinds of speculative views, and that they've got rid of the search for sensuality, a search for rebirth, and a search for a holy life. And they also got rid of any kinds of thoughts of three kinds of wrong thoughts: sensuous, cruelty, and angry thoughts. And then the next one is that they are one who is of who has tranquilized the bodily activities. Okay, pasada kaya sankhara. So remembering that kaya sankhara, in the context of anapanasati, refers to the breath, bodily activities. So it's tranquilized the bodily activities here, because the bhikkhu, with the abandoning of pleasure and the abandoning of pain and the previous disappearance of joy and grief, without pain and pleasure, with mindfulness purified by equanimity, enters and abides in the second, in the fourth jhana. This bhikkhu is how the bhikkhu has tranquilized the bodily activities. Okay, so this is the fourth jhana. So here it doesn't actually say that the breath has ceased, but there is somewhere else where it, I can't find the exact quality, but that passage says explicitly that it ceased. But here it's basically saying the same thing. It doesn't, it's not quite as explicit, but it's saying the same thing. Yeah. So and then the mind is well released from greed, hatred, and delusion. And then they have the wisdom that their mind has been released from greed, hatred, and delusion.
Can I ask a more general question?
Yeah,
of course. How do the jhanas facilitate attaining enlightenment?
That's the next bit of the sutta. We could talk about that. I mean, the only reason I don't answer that is because I couldn't, you know, keep on going for several hours on that particular topic. But it is actually the very next passage in the sutta, which actually I wasn't going to go into.
Are you going to teach it next week?
Well, not 100% sure. But the basic idea is very simple, is that with the jhanas, and especially with the fourth jhana, is that the mind is very clear. This is the most basic idea. The mind is incredibly clear, and insight becomes very, very powerful.
So can you then use your mind to focus to analyse certain things?
Absolutely, yeah. And again, that's exactly what the very next passage is saying. Just come to it, and then it goes on to a series of different eight different knowledges, but each one of them, it starts out, then he, with the mind thus concentrated and purified, bright, anangane, without obstacles, rid of defilements, become mudu, become gentle, become soft, kamaniye, workable, tite, steady, anandapate, attained to imperturbability, then he bends and inclines his mind towards knowledge and vision. Okay, so this is the basic passage, and then he understands, and this is the first of the eight series of knowledges. He understands, this is my body, is built of the four great elements, produced by mother and father, built up out of rice and bread, and is subject to rubbing, wearing, and fading away. And this, my consciousness, is bound up and connected to it. Yeah? So this is the first insight.
And these things come naturally, or one has to?
Well, kind of a bit of both. Yeah. I mean, there's an active sense here where it says, you know, you're actually turning your mind, inclining it towards that inquiry. But it does depend on the individual. That basically, people, the more wisdom you have, and the more you've developed that wisdom and reflection beforehand, then the more naturally the mind will incline towards it afterwards. Obviously, if you haven't done any wisdom practice or any contemplation, and then you just go into samadhi, then you're not going to be inclined to inquire. But if you've got those teachings and so on beforehand, then when you come out, then your mind will go. That's why Ajahn Brahm always emphasises that it's just very natural, you don't have to do anything about it, but that's because for him it is. Yeah, whereas for other people, it's obviously it's not, that they just sort of just bliss out, and then, oh, that was nice bliss. Yeah, that's it.
Then you're probably also put in place this program of people to actually do this. It's quite really reasons to do this. It's programming them to do the stuff at the same time.
And so in the beginning, the mind is kind of absorbed, isn't it, by that bliss, and therefore can't really analyse another object.
That's right.
But by the end, it's more workable.
Exactly.
Directable.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is, and that's exactly what it's saying. Come in here, fit to do work.
Jump straight to the Rupa jhana. Is that the Rupa jhana?
No. You're really in a hurry, aren't you?
Can you simply use your imagination and focus on some kind of like, not a physical meditation object, and get your mind concentrated that way?
That is what the non-physical.
Like some kind of images? Whatever state, think about.
But an image, an image is a rupa. That's precisely what a rupa is.
So you can't jump?
You can't jump, no. See, this is why they're called, and this is like in the, those suttas which I was just looking at in the Anguttara, it's always the anupubha nirodha, the gradual cessation, or the anupubha vihara, the gradual attainments. There are these, oh, here we go. Oh, yeah, I found that passage, didn't I, by pure accident. Okay, so here's the gradual cessation. Here there are these nine gradual cessations. What nine? In the first jhana, one who's attained the first jhana, then perceptions of sensuality, karma sanya, have ceased. For one who's attained the second jhana, vitaka vichara has ceased. For one who's attained the third jhana, iti has ceased. For one who's attained the fourth jhana, asasa pasasa nirudha honti. Okay, the breathing in and out has ceased. For one who's attained the basis infinite space, perceptions of form has ceased. For one who's base of infinite consciousness, perceptions of the infinite space has ceased. For one who's attained to nothingness, the perception of infinite consciousness has ceased, and for one who's attained the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception, then perceptions of the sphere of nothingness has ceased, and one who's attained the cessation of perception of feeling, then perception and feeling has ceased. These are the nine gradual cessations. And then there's also the nine, next one is the nine gradual abidings or dwellings, anupubha vihara. What are the nine? First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, and then the arupas and so on. So it's always taught as being something which is like a gradual moving through these different kind of states. Oh yeah, well the jhana mastery, you can sort of pop in and out of them any time. Yeah, I mean that's a slightly, I guess a slightly kind of controversial kind of thing, but we could spend some more time on that, but I haven't spent a lot of time on it. The way that the Visuddhimagga sort of understands and explains jhana in some ways is different from in the suttas. So for example, they talk about entering a period of upachara in between each jhana, these kinds of things. So there are certain things which I haven't gone into in detail. It's worth understanding them because they are taught in the Pali system and other places, so it's worth understanding what they're talking about. And there is this idea that somebody who's mastered jhana can sort of just sort of pop into whatever jhana you want. So you just sort of pop into first jhana and then pop out of there and then into third jhana and from out of there into basically infinite space and then up to the next one and then back and in and out and so on. May it be so, friend, may it be so, that's all I can say. You know, there is a talk of mastery of these things in the suttas. It doesn't sort of explicitly say that. It says you can get into whatever jhana you want for as long as you want and so on. It doesn't sort of specifically say you can skip them and all of these kinds of things. So,
What about if you lose contemplate emptiness?
Contemplate emptiness? Well, why don't you try it and then you come back and tell us next week whether it works.
There's like actually referring to the story in the Insight Meditation Society, they do the Dhamma Nara, and they say people occasionally fall into the seventh jhana, there's nothingness. But I think Vipassana, if they kind of get the focus wrong, they fall into this jhana. Maybe they fall away from Bhanga to the instead of nothingness.
Probably more like what the word called Bhavanga in the time system, where you sort of fall into kind of just a kind of blank slate. I would imagine. I do think it's possible doing those vipassana meditations. I mean, it obviously is possible to get into jhanas. I mean, people do it, but I doubt very much if you can fall into the seventh jhana. I mean, you can probably get into first jhana, you know. But I doubt, personally, I'd be a bit skeptical about that. Yeah, but and also remember that in those kind of traditions, they're not that experienced about what jhana is, you know.
Why is there such a fear against jhana in the Vipassana tradition?
It's a fascinating topic. I think there's an underlying fear of pleasure. I think it's the psychological wellsprings of it is a fear of pleasure.
Why would there fear of pleasure?
Everyone fears pleasure. Well, that's the basis of the whole kind of ascetic tendency, isn't it? Yeah, you want to react against pleasure, and that's kind of speculative, and that's a complex kind of question, but it's interesting that it's been argued that the same dynamic has been noticed in Western psychology as well, and that Freud had there was this kind of fear of pleasure about the kind of some of the things that he was talking about, even though his name means joy, of course, and but he was like, you know, it was a big kind of issue. It's a problem for him. Like, pleasure is a problem for Freud. And possibly under that, you know, and he criticised meditation for being kind of just absorption into the oceanic oneness and so on. So he criticised samadhi for that reason.
I think maybe afraid of the irrational side of our psyche.
Exactly, yeah, the irrational.
To get the jhanas, we have to master that.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, you find in the suttas, the Buddha says, you know, this kind of pleasure should not be feared. Nambhayitambhan. Yeah? And I mean, the interesting thing about it is the very fact that he says that, meaning that the fear of it was there. Yeah, there was a fear of it. That's why he had to reassure them, no, this is not to be afraid. There's nothing harmful in it.
9.31.
The Anupabani wrote in 9.31, 9.32. And the next one is a kind of interesting one, the Anupubha Vihara Samapatiya, which is, what is it, got a translation, English translation from, useful translation, but it says that here are these nine gradual dwellings, these attainment of these nine tantric dwellings I'll teach you. Now, where sensual pleasures cease and where sensual pleasures, where those who've completely dispelled nirodhetva, completely ceased, sensual pleasures dwell, then I say that for sure that Venerable One is wishless, nibbuta, nibbanad, literally, crossed over, gone to the far shore to that degree of tadangena, okay, to that degree. So it's very kind of strong praise that he's giving there. I certainly would declare that Venerable One, his wishless nibbanad, crossed over, gone to the far shore as far as that respect of that thing. And then it goes on to say, where is that place where sensual pleasures have ceased? And that's of course the first jhana. And then he said, certainly, because an undeceitful and undelusory person would say sadhu and would rejoice and delight in those words. And having rejoiced and delighted in those words would pay respects, bow down, make anjali, and pay respects to the person who had made that attainment. And then it goes on to the second jhana where the vitaka vichara ends. Certainly, that good man has wishless nibbanaed, crossed over, gone to the far shore to that respect. And then when he's asked what is that, and he says, declares the second jhana, then certainly an undeceitful person would say sadhu, sadhu, and rejoice and delight in that and pay respects and bow to them. And similarly with the third jhana, fourth jhana, fifth, sixth, and so on, up to the cessation of perception of feeling.
So, how come
it's just useful. You know, it's good if you can do it. Yeah. But not necessarily essential. That's why in all the essential places where samadhi is defined, like in the Eightfold Path and the Five Indriyas and so on, it's always before jhanas. Yeah, and the other higher ones are taught quite often, but they're not kind of essential in the same way.
So really jhana is for the clarity, the fourth jhana gives.
In certain places, you know, the Buddha would teach the formless attainments to certain individuals, but to others he wouldn't.
By mastering samadhi completely and growing wisdom, by going from the eighth jhana to the ninth, that's nirvana samapatti.
Yeah, well, this is what Ajahn Brahm says, is this is the pure samatha path, for which there's actually far, far more textual evidence than there is for a pure vipassana path in the suttas. Yeah? And this is exactly what this particular one doesn't actually say that. It's just this one says just go into the cessation of perception of feeling, but then there are some that say, you know, he then emerges from the cessation of perception of feeling and then realizes nibbana. So yeah, if you want to argue that from the text, you certainly can.
So would you now completely ignore wisdom and just try to manage?
But yeah, except you've got your right view, of course, at the beginning, so you've still got the right view. Practically, I think it's, you know, pretty rare for somebody to do that, but certainly the textual evidence is there. Yeah. So you got that, but in terms of like specific meditative practices to develop vipassana,
I remember one teacher saying that someone enters cessation of perception of feeling, they can either orchestral musical playing along to.
Right, exactly, yeah.
But the only possible result is.
So, I mean, you could argue that the vipassana aspect is implied through that, which is probably the more reasonable interpretation, but. Yeah, you always got a little bit of wisdom.